The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
Oh, it's good to be back here with you today. We are coming to you from the Carter Subaru Studio and streaming on Facebook Live. Welcome to The Big Show. Did I miss anything last week? Anything happened while I was gone?
Oh, my goodness.
Anything happened? Anything going on?
That was here? A rough week.
Yeah,
not because our host didn't do awesome. He did great.
Sure.
Yeah, it was just exactly. A lot of news. Just what was in the news was rough.
Oh, yeah. I heard about that. That was funny because my wife and I, we went down to Florida. I'll tell you all about the award show in Big Lead at 1 o'clock.
Including whether you won or not. That's
the
tease.
Yeah, that's the cliffhanger there. But we spent all day Thursday sitting in a hotel room watching all of the testimony, and it was and then I'm thinking I should be on the air. I should be back home. I should have been there back. I'm feeling guilty that I'm sitting down in Florida watching all of this because I should have been here with you.
I'll never leave us again.
I'm never going anywhere ever again. That's
except
what
for London next week.
Yeah, except for that, maybe. Maybe we'll see. We'll see what happens in the news. So anyway, we'll talk about a lot of that a little bit later this afternoon. But we got a lot of news to get to. Let's get right into The Big Lead.
The Big Lead. Top story.
Coming up, we got great guests coming up a little bit later today. At 1:30, I'm going to talk with a local woman named Maria Ball. She's training for the New York Marathon. And she was out for a run about 6:30 Friday morning in the Green Lake Ravenna neighborhood when a presumed homeless guy came out of nowhere and grabbed her breast and her crotch area. And she screamed. She talked to Q13 News about what went down.
I shoved my elbows back and I screamed as loud as I could because I knew my life was at risk. I didn't know if he had a weapon. I didn't know if he was going to shove me in the back of the van. I didn't know what was going to happen to me.
Maria is going to come on with us at 1:30 this afternoon because, once again, it illustrates how our politicians have let the streets of our entire region. This is happening all over the Puget Sound area. And we're letting the drug addicts just take over the streets. They're assaulting women. She filed a police report, and we will talk to Maria at about 1:30 this afternoon. Also, coming up at the bottom of the hour, 12:30, Brock Huard, the Monday Monson quarterback, will join us. And we'll talk about that Seahawk game yesterday, but perhaps even more than the result of the game, it's the one incident as Earl Thomas got injured.
And Arizona is a point away from tying this up. Rosen with the first touchdown pass of his NFL career, likely won't be the last. And a Seahawk player stays down at about the 10-yard line. And it looks like Earl. It is.
It was Earl Thomas. The same injury he had a couple of years ago. Fractured his lower left leg, the tibia. And it is no doubt season-ending. It's no doubt his last play ever with the Seahawks. And you all saw what happened, that as he was being carted off the field, he flipped off the Seahawks sideline. What a shame. And we're talking about one of the greatest players ever to wear a Seahawks uniform, and his final image as a Seahawk is flipping off the Seattle sideline. And we'll talk a lot with Brock Huard about that. Brock talked to Pete Carroll about it this morning. And Coach had a lot of interesting things to say. So I'll play what Pete Carroll had to say. And we'll talk with Brock Huard about that sad end to Earl Thomas as a Seahawk. So that's the Monday Monson quarterback. That's coming up at 12:30 this afternoon. But there's a lot of other news going on. Next up in the Big Lead.
The Big Lead, big local.
So as I was watching the Kavanaugh hearings down in Florida, and I'll get into that a little more in depth, and I know that it got talked to death late last week, but I haven't had a chance to share my thoughts. We have a local version of the Kavanaugh story happening here in our state. A woman has accused Republican State Senator Joe Fain of having raped her back in 2007. And this woman, her name is Candace Faber, she detailed for KUOW and on Twitter what she says happened back in 2007. Joe Fain has categorically denied this allegation. And this illustrates, you know, whether it's the Kavanaugh thing or the Joe Fain thing, but this illustrates these perilous times where we're in, because I have no idea about the Joe Fain thing. I haven't heard him talk about it. I haven't heard this woman. I've read her accounts. I've reached my conclusion about the Kavanaugh thing. I'll tell you about that in just a few minutes here. But an allegation that serious, of course it should be investigated. And both Democrat and Republican leaders in our state say that they want this allegation against Senator Joe Fain thoroughly investigated. Jay Inslee's office has said the same thing. And I would echo that. This is a serious allegation. It deserves to be investigated. Where we are in such perilous times is, I will tell you, one of the standards that we have, we will have people email us all the time, text us, and they will tell us about some crime that they were victimized by. And one of the first questions we always ask is, did you file a police report? Because I cannot simply take the word of somebody who gets hold of us and they allege something and put them on the air. That would be an irresponsible way to do the show. And by, you know, most news organizations' journalistic standards, you have to have some corroborating evidence, or, like I said, a police report is kind of the minimum standard. You cannot just take somebody's word and go on the air with it. But in the world of politics today, that's what we are doing, because it has proven to be, and like I said, if these allegations might be true, but they might not be true. And that's the one perspective that seems to be completely missing in all of these conversations. We are supposed to just take the word of people who, you know, did not file a police report at the time, who don't have any evidence. They are just talking about it, you know, in the case of Joe Fain, 11 years later. In the case of Brett Kavanaugh, 36 years later. And we're supposed to take somebody's word on it. And I will tell you that I have seen the most vile in humanity. I could open up my email box. I mean, some of the things, because people, you know, disagree with me on political or social issues, and they have said some things about me, like the fact that I coached my three daughters in basketball and loved it and wanted to be a part of, you know, bringing, educating, coaching, teaching life lessons that come through sport, that I wanted to keep doing that even after my daughters graduated. And people have said the most hideous, vile things. So I know a little bit about how people will, because they disagree with you politically, socially, they will say some of the worst things imaginable about a person. And so from that perspective, I understand that, yes, we got to investigate these things. I also understand that there are some hideous, horrible human beings who will say crap about somebody because they don't like their political or social views. And so that kind of informs my perspective on how I look at these stories. Now, the Joe Fain thing needs to be thoroughly investigated, and I have no opinion on whether this allegation is true or not. I haven't heard from, we've invited both the woman and Joe Fain to come on the show. I'm hoping that they will respond sometime soon. But here's what this woman, Candace Faber, alleged happened to her. She was graduating from a master's program at Georgetown University in 2007. And what she told KUOW is that as she was graduating, her parents, who lived here in Washington State, she wanted to impress them. as they went back to D.C. for her college graduation. She scheduled a tour of congressional buildings on Capitol Hill for them. She got some special passes, and she and her parents stumbled into a reception where they met, as Faber put it, a tall, blue-eyed, conventionally attractive Republican guy. And that was Joe Fain. So Ms. Faber was 23 years old. He was 25 years old at the time. He was not a senator then. He was just working his way up in the world of politics. So they started chatting. She says he offered her his business card. She said to KUOW, "I know that I was flirting with him, and I know that I felt like successful in getting his card and proving to my parents that I was going to be good at life." She came out as a lesbian last year, but in 2007, she was still struggling with her sexuality and wanting to please her conservative parents. After the graduation ceremony, she was driving to her class's after party at a D.C. bar. Her father asked if she had contacted that nice young man, meaning Joe Fain. They met in Congress. She said that she then texted Fain to invite him to the after party at the bar. When Fain showed up, Faber said that he bought her drinks and they danced and kissed on the dance floor. She said she remembered feeling like she had made it, but still felt pressure to resolve her conflicting feelings about her sexuality. She had sought counseling about this, and she said Fain represented a chance to prove she was going to be fine. She says that Fain continued to drink. He got loud and obnoxious. She said she was holding him up on the dance floor, which was difficult because he was a much bigger person than her. And she asked him to leave, but he insisted he was too drunk to get to his hotel alone. He insisted on basically not leaving unless I walked him, she said. Faber said she told her friends that she would return to the party after dropping him off at his hotel, that he was kind of dragging his body over hers as they were going to the hotel. And she said she was going to deposit him in his room and then get back to the party with friends. But when they got to the hotel room, she says suddenly he wasn't bleeping weak anymore, and he had no problem throwing me on the bed and ripping my dress off. She repeatedly told Fain to stop. She said she stood up and asked if he had a, he asked if she had a condom. She said she didn't, but he raped her anyway. I remember that that was when I decided to look out the window. She says she does not remember how that part of the night ended, but she told, I don't know if this was, she told the Seattle Times or she said this on Twitter, but she said at the end of the night, she asked him for a kiss goodnight. She didn't file a police report because she was worried about reactions from her parents. And she said, plus, I didn't think anyone would believe me or that if they did, they wouldn't care. Ms. Faber, she had a mental health breakdown last year. She says she was diagnosed with a psychosis triggered by a buildup of traumas, including this alleged rape. She also said that she's had several, been the victim of several sexual assaults. She told KUOW that in high school she was sexually assaulted. She said that in college she had passed out after a night of drinking and was sexually assaulted then. She says she was sexually assaulted by Senator Joe Fain as well. Okay, obviously this needs to be investigated. But I also know that there are an awful lot of people who are just automatically believing her story. And saying that, you know, why would somebody put themselves through this? And they're saying the same thing about Christine Ford. And what I do know is that people use things like this on occasion, that sometimes they're true, and sometimes people for political and social reasons, and we're talking about the highest levels of power here. You know, nationally, a seat on the Supreme Court that, you know, 50% of the country doesn't want to see go to this guy, 50% do. But, well, do people go to extraordinary lengths when we're talking about the most powerful positions on Earth? Yeah, that's a possibility. It is not certain. So we'll wait to see. And as I said, I've invited both Ms. Faber, the accuser, and State Senator Joe Fain to come on the show. I'd like to hear their sides of things. That is one where I have absolutely no idea if it's true or not. I will tell you, after watching all the Kavanaugh stuff on Thursday, my wife and I sat and watched it, and I heard everybody talk about how compelling Christine Ford's testimony was, and it kind of was, but I also thought that, you know, she came across, and maybe she's, you know, loony because she truly was a victim, but she didn't seem credible to me. And I know a lot of women who have reached that same conclusion. Kavanaugh, I believed his testimony. I believed his passion. And I told you last week that if he actually did what he's accused of, that there would have been a far different political and public relations strategy that he would have embraced. And that is, yeah, we were drinking, we had party, we had sex together. I don't know why she's going with this. I mean, there are lots of ways this thing would have been painted and colored if it went down the way Christine Ford alleges. But man, I tell you what, the pressure of somebody makes an accusation, you must believe it. It's ridiculous. Sometimes they're true and sometimes they aren't. But the mania, and I'm watching this weekend, the absolute rip job done on Kavanaugh and his testimony Saturday Night Live, John Oliver's show last night, all the late night shows. It's they've all made up their minds, and you apparently are not allowed to say anything that doesn't follow the politically correct opinion. Well, I don't believe that we should give an opinion just because everybody is demanding it. So we'll talk a lot more about all of this. That for now is your big lead for today.
The big lead on Cairo Radio.
The other huge local story, the Seahawks, Earl Thomas flipping off the Seahawks sideline. All things that I'm going to talk with Brock Huard about. The Monday Monson quarterback. That's coming up next here on the Dory Monson Show.
The Monday Monson quarterback.
Blue in it, check. Brown 24 Razor.
Brought to you by IRG Physical and Hand Therapy on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Where the 12s hear the Hawks.
He's going to drop the ball underneath. The ball is caught. It's Jimmy Graham. And that was all Russell Wilson.
Here's Dory Monson.
Well, when you get off to a 0-2 start, the best you can do after four games is be at 500, and that's where the Seahawks are this afternoon. But man, that was a costly win yesterday. It is time for the Monday Monson quarterback. Joining us from Seahawks headquarters, Brock Huard. Good afternoon, sir.
Hello, Dory. Yes, it was. That stadium has just been a terror in that way. Obviously, you know, last year it was Cam and Richard. I mean, very clearly, even with that turf with Richard and his Achilles, and then obviously this year to lose one of the last members of that Legion of Boom, Earl Thomas, with a significant broken lower leg, that is a bummer.
Yeah, it really was. Well, let's start with the Earl thing, because that's obviously the big national story. It was on Drudge last night, and this clearly transcended football because, you know, the injury was, you know, from a football standpoint, obviously bad for the team. Flipping off the sideline, the Seahawks sideline, as he was being carted off the field. It's a shame, Brock, because he is clearly one of the greatest players in the history of this organization, and the fact that that is going to be the last visual of him ever as a Seahawk. It's really a shame.
Yeah, and then you compile that last year, one of the, I think, strong images of him running to the Cowboys locker room and hugging their coach and screaming, bring me home. It was about Earl the last couple of years. It was about Earl. It wasn't about this team. It just wasn't about the brotherhood. It just wasn't. It was going to be about Earl getting his last big deal, feeling totally disrespected that he did not get a third contract from a team that had given him, and he'd earned almost $60 million, and he wanted more. And he made that abundantly clear, even, I think, in that moment of pain, chaos, you know, coach saying he was clear thought and all of it obviously hitting him. Yeah. But as he's carted off, it is the middle finger to an organization that he felt, I don't know, all along just disrespected him in the end.
Well, I thought you guys had a great conversation. Pete Carroll's first post-game conversation is always with Brock and Salk on Monday mornings. And here is Pete talking about the injury itself.
What a shame. You know, we'd made such a good turn and heading in a good direction, and then he just has to deal with that. I really think that, I know there's been a lot of talk about it. I think you got people that are – or criticizing whatever happened, don't understand. This was an earth-shattering moment for a kid. You know, he's trying to play this game he loves, and all of a sudden this happens again. He knew exactly what had happened to him. He went right to what it's going to take to get back, and all the he had it all just totally figured out, and it's as emotional as you can get. But he was very chilled about it. You know, on the field, he was an unbelievable stud about handling it, and give him a little slack. You know, this is very, very difficult moment that most people would never understand what that was all about.
And I'm always intrigued about that with Pete Carroll, that while everybody's focusing on the tumult, he's give him slack. You know, he's always trying to play it from the player's perspective.
It's amazing. He is a labor guy.
yeah, that's right.
I think in our years of talking to him, and you do every week as well during the football season, it's very clear, Dory, that ideologically there's some differences, but especially with you and I and him and how we see some of this. And even as a head coach there, even working on the management side that he does and some of the other titles he has on that side, he is about the labor. He is about those guys, and he has an empathy and just a grace that even when they spit in his face, even when they flip him off, even when they throw him under the bus and his team and or his coaches and everybody else, that he just has an amazing grace and an amazing amount of compassion and empathy for them that certainly other coaches in this league for decades and decades and decades and decades have not shown.
Well, and you made it very clear on Twitter last night that you were very critical of Earl in that moment, how he handled it.
Yeah, I thought I was sad because that's the last image. Not all the sacrifice and the selflessness, not playing a Super Bowl with a totally torn shoulder, Dory, which he did, and other guys would not have played, not playing through other injuries and everything else he's done, but really the last 2 years, because he didn't get his. He has felt so disrespected by this organization that he was going to look out, and he said as much. It's not me judging it. It was him saying it last week after the game. I will look out for me. If I got a headache, I am playing. It's all going to be about me, and that just doesn't fly that in a team sport. And I went on quite a little rant this morning, but bottom line is just this, Dory, is I think when you become that narcissistic and it's all about you, you forget the hundreds that are in line behind you that want that job and want that opportunity. And trust me, there will be. Just as Shaquille Griffin has filled in for Richard Sherman and not even thought about losing Richard Sherman the last 4 games. He's been great. Yeah. He's had picks. He's played tremendous. There will be the next guy that follows. There always will be. It's not about you in this team game. And he thinks he's irreplaceable. He thinks he's the greatest ever. He thinks he's all of these things. He thinks he's been so disrespected when eventually, and he will see this and he will feel it. And probably when he's done, years from now, realize, man, there's a lot of other guys that could do this job. And even some of them that could do it as well as I have.
Well, and I hope he also gets a sense of perspective when he talks about being so disrespected that this is an organization that's paid the man, what, about $50
million? $55 million or something.
$55 million.
Mm-hmm. And he's going to, and by the way, he's going to collect, he actually saved himself money with that injury this season because he no longer will skip practices and be fined. He will collect the rest of his $6 million this year. Seriously.
Yeah, I know.
You know, he's going to collect every penny of it this year, much like Cam Chancellor's collecting, what, $7 million, $8 million this year, not playing, that they've got to pay, that you do get what's on your contract if you do get injured, and now he will get what he wants, and that's to see what the market thinks of him when he will be healthy by February, fully healthy, and whether the market is going to respect him the way that he thinks it should.
I'm going to play kind of a long clip from your interview with Pete Carroll this morning, because that issue of grace, I thought it was really fascinating to hear what you asked and coach's response.
Does grace come natural to you?
I don't know.
You seem to have a lot of grace. And I say that quite honestly, because a lot of these players, and you know, the Richard thing that we talked through last year, and some of the players that have thrown barbs your way, and obviously, you know, wherever that gesture was directed at, you have had an amazing sense of grace with so many of these players through the years.
Well, I have a clear sense with these guys about where they are and all they're dealing with at this young age, and they're trying to figure things out, and they deserve latitude, and they deserve understanding and empathy. They just, you know, they're trying to do what's right, and it's hard, you know, it's challenging. And everybody, you know, always has these easy observations that you should do this and you should do that, you know, and they don't get it. It's hard. I mean, these guys are, they're not just going through football, they're going through life changes and futures and marriages and kids and everything else that they're trying to figure out, and all of the pressure to try to stay on top of it. There's a lot going on, and they just deserve a lot of a lot of consideration and understanding and a lot of support and a lot of love to help them through it. And someday I'm not worried about where these guys are right now. I know someday they'll see things differently, and when they have a chance to look back, and I'm not worried about what that observation is going to look like to them.
As I was listening to that, Brock, you know, I'm always thinking, are there things I can learn? I've learned a lot about coaching from talking to Pete Carroll. And I was thinking about that. Should I be more like that? And I don't know the answer. I don't know, because I don't know that all that grace that he extends has led to something that manifestly makes the team better. I don't know the answer to that, because I know that I would not, I'd carry around baggage if I felt like somebody was not returning whatever considerations I was extending their way.
Yeah, if you're wrong for an award that you deserve. If that were to happen, how would you feel in that moment? Isn't there something, just that wisdom that's gained when you're 67, man? And you've been there and you've done it and you've seen it all. I mean, you've been fired. You've been run out of a league. You were like the fifth choice at USC, and then you went on this dynastic run, and that didn't end well, though, you know, in the end. And then you come here, and you provide this community the greatest sports moments that it's ever had, right? And Salk asked me a pretty good question this morning. I couldn't really answer. I probably have to think about it through the day and some time. But he said, was this ever going to end well? I mean, is this ever with these personalities? Wasn't this going to be the natural trade-off? And you knew it when Richard was screaming, you know, through Aaron Andrews' microphone and becoming what, you know, he became, and this huge figure. And didn't you know it when Earl is as headstrong and athletically arrogant as he is? And didn't you just know that ultimately it couldn't end well? How else could it have possibly ended with some of these guys? So for Pete, I think he knew it. And all along, he's just got to have a grace and an empathy that, you're right, surpasses maybe some of ours, certainly with these players.
Yeah, well, that's a great point. And there are so many. I mean, it is so rare when any sports, this period of time ends well. I mean, even the great revered Don James at Washington, the way that ended. I mean, it just, yeah, I can't think of too many examples where it's been.
Ken Griffey gets in his SUV and drives through the middle of the night. Lou Piniella goes, and now he's running senior homes in Tampa. And right? I mean, it just, tell me where and how this thing was supposed to end. And then, you know, yesterday, in such that crushing image of all of it that brought it all to life for the whole world to obviously see and commentate on.
All right. And the game itself, that was a nice ending.
From 52, Michael Dixon puts it down. The kick has got legs. It is there. It is good. Hey. Sebastian Janikowski kicks it through. The Seahawks win on the last play of the game.
I like Wyman there. Yay.
What was that noise?
So much. 20-17, Seahawks win it.
Yeah, they won it ugly, Dory, and there will be no style points. Okay, when we talk on Mondays this season, there will be no pretty style points. There's going to be no 50-14 win. There's going to be no L.A. Rams greatest show on turf redo. There's going to be none of it. If this team's going to win, they're going to be like that heavyweight boxer that just holds on, that just mugs people, that gets it to the end, that wins a close decision. That's the way they're going to play. Yeah. And you know what? That could beat Arizona again. That that could certainly beat San Francisco twice. That's in your own division. You know, that method is how Carolina plays anyway, how Minnesota play. Like, you look at the schedule, that methodology, you know, could get them 7, 8, who knows, maybe 9 wins this season. And with this NFC, that may be relevant in the month of December.
By the way, I don't like to blow my own horn, Brock, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a very humble man.
Did you call the score?
Let's see.
Well, I think Seahawks are the better team, clearly, but I don't know that they are good enough yet to be, you know, big favorite on the road. So right. I got Seahawks winning it 21-17 will be your final score today.
Just a point off. Yeah. Just a point off.
I know. Furious about that too.
No, that's not bad, Dory. Try again. It's pretty darn close. Well done, kid.
Okay. All right, good stuff. Everybody should go to your podcast, Brock and Salk, on 710 ESPN site, because that was an interesting interview with Coach. I'm looking forward to talking to him on Friday.
Yeah, and I know people wanted, and probably some wanted, just as the players, people wanted Pete to have a pound of flesh with these players, right?
Yeah.
And I'm sure there were some today like, oh, you better get a pound of flesh from Pete today. Like, you better just dig into him, you know, but he is going to just kill a bunch of it with grace and kindness, and he did yet again.
Yep, and now they've scrambled back into it football-wise, too. All right, you can hear Brock every morning, 7-10 on 710 ESPN. Monday Monson Quarterback is brought to you by IRG Physical and Hand Therapy. Good stuff, Brock. I appreciate it.
You got it, Dory.
And we got lots more straight ahead. It's the Dory Monson Show.
Rolls on, rolls on, rolls on, rolls on.
Oh, I am reading all of your messages from the Online Trading Academy text line. At 98973, that's 98973. And people furious if I've reached a different conclusion from them on the Ford Kavanaugh thing. Which is what I find so bizarre, is if you watched all of the testimony by both people and you believe Christine Ford, that's your prerogative. I couldn't care less if you've reached a different conclusion. But, oh, man, I'm checking out the text messages, and because I say, look, something that happened 36 years ago, there's no corroborating evidence, and I thought he was compelling in his emotional testimony. And, people are just furious. Here you are telling every woman listening that if they come out against a powerful man, they'll be called a liar. No, what I said is I found his testimony and his story of what went down to be more believable than hers. But on and on it goes from people that you can't believe that I have any female coworkers that don't walk out on me. Can't believe that I have daughters. This cult-like mentality that I have to believe what you believe. I have to reach the same conclusion as you? Where does that come from? And I'm telling you that when I watched, you know, Kavanaugh seems like a good man to me. Christine Ford, she seems crazy to me, but maybe she's crazy because she was sexually assaulted. You know, maybe by somebody else. I don't know. But she just came across as. But I'm watching over the weekend. Saturday Night Live got monstrous ratings because they had Matt Damon on to do a Brett Kavanaugh impression.
I'm here tonight because of a sham, a political con job orchestrated by the Clintons, George Soros, and Kathy Griffin. And Mr. Ronan Sinatra.
Now, okay, so they got monster ratings for that. Matt Damon, who did everything in his power when there was overwhelming evidence against Harvey Weinstein, that Weinstein was a serial sex abuser of women. And Matt Damon knew about it. And he did interview after interview last fall where he wanted to... You know, he made all kinds of excuses for Harvey Weinstein because Harvey was politically great for Matt Damon. And to see Matt Damon, who enabled Harvey Weinstein, to see him now for the sake of Saturday Night Live comedy to just join the masses? It's a weird world. What a stinking hypocrite Damon is. Okay, Fastest 15 is coming up next.